You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So in today's episode, I'd like to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, namely because it's been such a hot topic since Trump came back into office. You know, one of the very first things that he did as president the second time around was roll back on all federally financed DEI programs. And what that in practice means is that, like, any sort of research that was underway that focused on marginalized groups, whether that be like women, whether that be poor people, whether that be sex workers, whether that be LGBT people, whether that be people with disabilities, like basically anybody where it's a specific group that's being targeted for a program and it's on the basis of their marginalization, then what that means in practice is that, you know, those kinds of programs won't be financed or funded any longer. Although I have to say, when I was prepping for this episode, I saw that a judge had already blocked many of these attempts at blocking DEI-based programs or programs that explicitly focus on DEI. So it remains to be seen if this is like one of the things that Trump says with great pomp and fair, where he makes proclamations and he takes like extreme actions that gain a lot of like publicity, but they never actually stick. Like we saw that happen with the tariffs, where, you know, was trying to sanction all these different countries, was trying to sanction Mexico, was trying to sanction Canada, was trying to sanction China. But actually, when you look now, like a few weeks later, many of those tariff pledges or sanctions or threats basically haven't materialized. Ditto with the deportations. If you notice, like, a lot of them have slowed down because, one, it's very difficult to get public buy-in, and there has been a lot of non-cooperation from the public and also a lot of scrutiny around even just like the legality of these deportations. So again, with the DEI stuff, I would imagine like 6 months from now, a lot of these will be like something that he said that was only partially implemented. But to be honest, like, the DEI conversation is actually a lot bigger than Trump. So we can focus on what's happening right now and what he did with like the rolling back of the DEI funding for federal programs. But when you zoom out and look even like a year or two back, there had been a lot of backlash around DEI policies, specifically around corporate DEI. So remember, actually, even before I go into the corporate DEI, if you remember 2 years ago or so, there was the end of affirmative action in higher education. And that resulted as a consequence of like infighting, essentially, where Asian Americans came together. I mean, some Asian Americans came together and they partnered with like this far right like lawyer. And they basically challenged the Supreme Court on the basis that, I mean, the claim that they were making was that African Americans were taking Asian American spots. And what they were saying was that they believed that Asian Americans were getting the same or if not better scores, but consistently African Americans were getting their spots. And so they believed that as a consequence of affirmative action in higher education, it was disadvantaging Asian Americans. Long story short, as you might know by now, the Supreme Court ends up siding with the Asian American community and they remove affirmative action in higher education in the way that it used to exist. What happens, though, is really interesting afterwards, is that it turns out that Asian Americans without affirmative action get fewer spots, because that's literally what happened. After the Supreme Court ruled in their favor, the numbers across most universities, like specifically the prestigious ones that Asian Americans were basically targeting, like imagine the Harvards and the Princes and the Yales and the UCLAs, all their numbers essentially went down. Like, fewer Asian Americans were admitted to those universities. So then the Asian American community come together again and they basically say that they are being penalized or punished for having challenged affirmative action through the Supreme Court. And then they try to sue some of these universities again. Okay, so park that to one side. So already the idea that DEI advantages African Americans is sort of central to that story. That's what they're saying. They're saying that African Americans are the beneficiaries of affirmative action or DEI policies in this case, and it's to the detriment of other groups. In this situation, it is to the detriment of Asian Americans. Now, when you skip ahead to what's going on right now and the executive order that Trump signed in like January, is again like this conflation or this representation of affirmative action and DEI policies as being like primarily beneficial to African Americans, when the reality is just not true. Like, the biggest beneficiaries of DEI is actually white women, and that is a well-researched, well-chronicled fact. And so when Trump and his supporters like racialize DEI in the sense that they make it seem as though African Americans or Black people are the ones who are benefiting from this program, they're hoodwinking. Because I can only assume, I mean, not assume, I know this, we know this, they have access to the data. Like, they can, they, if they wanted to, could categorize, they could take all the money that goes to DEI policies, and they could split it into silos of different groups. They could tell us how much goes to people with disabilities. They could show us how much goes to poor farmers. They could tell us how much goes to research on sex workers and people who are end up being trafficked or who end up in that world. They could tell us how much money goes towards women of all ethnicities, and specifically white women as a category. And they could go on with all the different groups or subgroups that exist in the US. And I guarantee you, because we have this research already, and I'll link a couple of articles, a couple of research studies in the show notes, we know that African Americans are not the biggest recipients or beneficiaries of DEI. And so when I consider that, when I look at the Asian American incident, when I look at what's happening right now, a part of me feels like a little bit satisfied in that it feels like turkeys voting for Christmas, essentially. It feels like with the Asian American situation, it shows a deep misunderstanding of the actual condition they find themselves in. They must think, or they must not realize, that racist people, like racist Americans, white racist Americans, are white supremacists. That's why we use the term specifically, because we have to define what racism means in the US context. And it means different things in different places, but in the US context, white racism means white supremacy. It means they believe in the supremacy of the white genes, of whiteness, of white culture. They ideally would like to have a world in which white people have all the money, have all the power, have all the domination, and people who are not white, that is, all people who are not white, would be subservient to them. I mean, to be honest, ideally they want to go back to slavery and they want to enslave anybody who's not white, but and they want to make sure that they don't reproduce at numbers greater than the white population. That's essentially what they want. And so for Asian Americans to believe that if affirmative action was removed from higher education, that they would then be welcomed with open arms by these white institutions, obviously shows that they don't understand the degree to which racist white America hates them. Like, and to be honest, like, it's so hidden in plain sight. I wouldn't even describe it as hidden. If you're somebody who enjoys action films, like big blockbuster action films, especially ones where the main character, like the main protagonist, is a white person, usually a white man, you will notice that it tends to follow a very well-followed recipe or script, shall we say. And usually what happens is you've got like this alpha macho like white protagonist, and the villain, the counter to the protagonist, the antagonist, is either a generic, nondescript Eastern European villain. Like, they never tell you where they're from. They just give them an Eastern European country and they'll talk about how they're from Eastern Europe, but they'll never tell you specifically which country they're from. So either the villain is Eastern European or the villain is Asian. Like, it's, and again, they'll never specify where the Asian villain is from. It'll just be like the good guy is a white American, and the villain is either a generic white Eastern European person or a generic Asian person. And the Asian person, we don't know if they're from Korea. We don't know if they're from Taiwan. We don't know if they're from Japan or China. We just know that the villain is a Chinese person. And to be honest, this has great precedent. Like, it's not just in, like, modern times that we see that trope happening. If you even go back, I used to watch, like, real old films, like Audrey Hepburn films, Marilyn Monroe films, went through a period. And they would also have Asian characters sometimes. So they, some of the racist stuff they would have in there is they would have the classic mammy, where they would have like a black woman who was like there to essentially be like a surrogate mother slash like slave essentially, but happy for like happy in her position. And then the other racist trope that they would have would be an Asian man who was usually crazy in some way or weird in some way. They've changed it now. Now they don't give them like buck teeth. Now they don't make them like just stupid, but they still show them as villains. And so for me, like, I always noticed, that's one of the things I notice. I always notice these racist tropes as they relate to Asian Americans or Asians, sorry, in general, or Eastern European. And I noticed that specifically because one of the things I see is that they don't tend to make the villains like Africans, because again, that racism would be way too obvious. So they make it a bit more subtle by just having like an Asian person as a villain, or an Eastern European person as a villain. So anyway, going back to the Asian American sort of like delusion, I wonder what they think when they see these films, because it's not just like one or two films, it's in a lot of films. And if you go back and look at the big blockbusters, like I said, that have like white leads, you will see that that happens over and over again. Outside of that, like, even as somebody who is not American, doesn't live in America, even I know that there are lots of negative stereotypes against Asian Americans. Asian Americans tend to focus on the positive sides, like they're known for being nerdy or studious or like good at maths, but there's also lots of negative stereotypes around being untrustworthy or being conniving or being insert whatever stereotypes that we all know. And so again, with going back to the affirmative action, like, part of it is very interesting from a sociological point of view, because it shows the desperation with which marginalized people will act, because they will act in ways that are against their own self-interest, and they will also be blinded to the ways in which the system really works, and they will also direct blame not to the right group, so i.e. the white institutions that block people of color in general from gaining access to those spaces. They won't blame those people, they'll blame other marginalized groups. So that's the first interesting thing, that when we look at what's happening now as well with the DEI policies and the racialization of the DEI policies and the implication that it's only African American or primarily African Americans that benefit from affirmative action or DEI policies, they're doing the exact same thing. The same sort of rationale or assumptions are built therein. The idea that it's for African Americans, when actually, again, like, the same white patriarchy that hates people of color also doesn't want women around, you know? So it's not as though we're going to get rid of DEI policies and the white women who are Trump supporters are suddenly going to be like in power or suddenly going to have agency or suddenly going to be welcomed into corporate America or into the halls of power, wherever they may reside, whether that's in politics or in the corporate sphere. That's not going to happen. Like, if you look through Project 2025, their ultimate aim, and this has started with the challenging of Roe v. Wade, of abortion, the ultimate aim is they don't want women in the workplace. And so what they've done is that they've done that thing where they divide and conquer, where they get different groups to fight against one another, and they convince them that if they can put one group down, that they will be accepted by the white patriarchy, essentially. But honestly, it's just another manipulation tactic. And you can actually already see that people like Trump supporters, people who thought that, you know, they could vote against other people's interests and not suffer the consequences themselves are already finding out that that's not the case. One of my favorite things to watch online right now is like people finding out that things that they thought would only affect marginalized groups also affects them. And DEI is basically one of those major things, like voting against immigrants, for example, and then finding out that the cost of eggs and the cost of everyday produce is going up, or voting for an administration that has basically given extreme control to somebody like Elon Musk, who is unelected, I don't even know if he's like officially on the government payroll, but they allow him to essentially become like a pseudo vice president. And then guess what? He cuts funding that supports small farmers, for example. Honestly, like this stuff like writes itself. Now, zooming out of specifically like the affirmative action that I was speaking about as it relates to the higher education and college, like in terms of the conversation around DEI and the backlash against DEI, as I said, it's been going on for a long time, because we even had a couple of years ago the backlash against Dylan Mulvaney with the Bud Light commercial. And in case you missed it, basically Bud Light, like the beer company, had a commercial and was a very sort of like, I would say like low production commercial in my view. But it basically featured like this trans woman called Dylan Mulvaney. And if you haven't seen any of Dylan Mulvaney's content, like they are a very, very flamboyant person. And I would say they just clearly do not align with Bud Light as a brand, you know? Like, it's not even their transness per se. It's just, of all the trans people you could have had, I would say Dylan Mulvaney is pre-transition and post-transition is probably the least likely person to be drinking a Bud Light. So in terms of being on brand, it didn't even make sense for them to make Dylan Mulvaney as the centerpiece of that specific commercial or advert. But anyway, long story short, there was like massive, massive backlash. Like, as you know, Bud Light like lost a whole bunch of money. It's a publicly traded company, and basically like their stock like completely dipped as a consequence. And out of that came this expression called go woke, go broke, like basically a term coined by the conservative right. And basically what they're saying, as the phrase implies, is the idea that companies stand to lose a great deal of money basically by being quote unquote too progressive. And Dylan Mulvaney and the incident with Dylan Mulvaney and the commercial with Bud Light basically sort of highlighted that. Outside of that, we also saw some other backlash around other companies like Target. Like a couple of years ago, I think maybe it was a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, Target came out with a swimsuit range that was specifically catered towards trans people. There was a little bit of misinformation in that they were saying that it was targeted towards like trans kids, but that's not true. Either way, out of that backlash, like there's been a great deal of shareholder action where they've tried to sue the company, and you can see that Target has really like withdrawn from a lot of those policies. And now with the DEI like executive order that Trump signed, they basically have used that as an excuse to pull back completely on all fronts, on all DEI measures. And to be honest, it's not even just them. Like the list is growing of the list of corporate retreating from DEI is long. So you have like Pepsi, you've got like Citigroup, you've got Coca-Cola, who, I mean, I saw this thing online where it said that Coca-Cola had called ICE on some of its employees, but I haven't been able to substantiate that, so I don't know if that's true or not. Other companies that have pulled back from DEI are Disney, Deloitte, the audit company, Google, and they were super quick to do it as well. PayPal, that's no surprise. Literally the founders are like white South Africans who were part of apartheid, who supported apartheid. And there's great content on TikTok actually that talks about like the PayPal mafia and their roots in apartheid. You should check that out. And then Meta, Walmart, and I'm sure the list is going to be growing. Now, when I think of like the backlash around for example, like Target's Pride campaign and their swimsuit and their swim line, or when I consider the Bud Light backlash with Dylan Mulvaney and like other things that we've seen like have like just massive, massive backlash. One of the things that I always feel and think is that the reason why there was backlash, for example, with the Dylan Mulvaney, I personally don't even think it was because Dylan Mulvaney was a trans person or is a trans person. Same with like the Target's like swim line. I don't think it's specifically because they've had a swim line or clothesline that's been brought out for Pride and celebrates Pride and is aligned with Pride. I don't think so. I think it's the way in which that it's done. And you can often tell that DEI policies were done without any like diverse people because of the results, and two, the way in which they go about it. Okay, simple example. Even with like Pride, you know how every year during Pride Month there'll be marches, like massive marches, especially if you're in a big city like London. Like Pride here is huge and I love it. It's a huge celebration. Like hundreds of thousands of people show up over that weekend. And whilst it's like a fun celebration, there's like lots of color, there's lots of pomp, there's lots of like music, there's like food stalls, and honestly, like, you get swept away by the size of the crowd, by the size of the people participating, like both gay and straight. So it's a huge celebration. But one of the things that I always notice, especially because I go to Black Pride in August, so I really contrast the main Pride with the Black Pride, and it's a completely different cultural experience, I have to tell you. So with the main Pride, the one that's attended by like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, you can tell there's lack of diversity in the planning. Namely, there are not enough women who have positions of power. There's not enough gay women or bisexual women who have positions of power in the organization of Pride, of like the main Pride in London. I can only speak to that one. And you can tell that because of some of the things that take place at Pride. Like, there are some, and I hate to say this, but I'm sorry, like, men, whether straight or gay, are sexual deviants. They're sexual deviants. Like, they will always push things. One, they'll always make things like super hyper sexual. You know, you turn like a fun celebration into completely focusing on sex. And two, it's not good enough just to make it like sex focused, because I do believe in sex positivity. But what you see at Pride sometimes is not, it goes beyond just being sex positive. About, it goes beyond openly discussing sex. It goes beyond being aware about safe practices in sex. It's like a display of people's like weird fetishes. Like, I remember I took my mom to Pride and there were men on all fours, like dressed as dogs, like being walked on the street, like in the middle of daylight, like in the middle of the day. Or like men with like their butt cheeks hanging out wearing like chaps. Or I saw these men as well who were walking around in skirts, and this isn't trans people, this is just men, like these sort of mini kilts, and they weren't wearing any underwear underneath. So what happened when there was a breeze is you got a full view of everything. Now, in the execution of Pride, in the sexual deviancy that is increasingly present at Pride, despite the fact that there's been calls and complaints by people at Pride that they don't want to see this, you can tell that it keeps happening because there's a lack of diversity in the organizing. And by that I mean there's clearly like not enough women in the organization of Pride. Because if there was, I tell you for free, they would shut that down. Like, they would be complaining, they would have those people removed, and they would like tame some of the excesses of like the sexual deviancy that takes place. Because, and I don't think this is just respectability politics, but correct me if I'm wrong, because there's a difference between celebrating people's sexual orientations, because ultimately, for a very long time, same-sex attracted people were criminalized. And so we can't just focus on the romantic aspect of like same-sex attraction. We also have to focus on the sex part of same-sex attraction, because it's the physical sex that was criminalized, where people were jailed, people were attacked, people were discriminated against. So I'm not suggesting that pride, for example, should be desexualized. But there's a difference between acknowledging and celebrating same-sex attractiveness and not and removing the shame and stigma that was piled on for many, many years. There's a difference between that and showcasing people's fetishes, because ultimately straight people have fetishes as well. There's straight people who like wearing gimp masks, or who like being gagged, or who like wearing, like I said, the dog suits or dog collars, or who like being walked on all fours, or who like being dressing in latex or dressing in chaps. All that, that's not unique. That's not unique to the gay sex experience, to the gay man sex experience, to the LGBT. Obviously, it's not. That specifically is kinks and fetishes. And as far as I'm aware, I don't think pride is about the display of people's unique, like people's specific fetishes. It's about the celebration and destigmatization of same-sex attracted people. And so again, with the lack of diversity in the planning and organizing and in the positions of power, for me, it's clearly evident there's not enough women in the room, because if there were, half of the weird stuff that we see would not happen. So again, going back to Target and Bud Light and those commercials, for me, like, it just is so evident that whoever devised that commercial with Dylan Mulvaney, for example, and I actually feel bad for Dylan Mulvaney, because all she did was accept a deal, like a brand reached out to her and said, hey, we've got this thing we'd like you to be involved with. She said yes, because it's money and it's Bud Light. And then she ended up getting basically hate from millions of conservatives, but she didn't do anything wrong by accepting an opportunity. Same with like the backlash against Target. Ultimately, trans people are or were being lashed at, but they weren't in the room when that decision was taken. They didn't decide on the swimsuits that were going to be advertised. They didn't decide on the slogans that were going to be put on clothes. They didn't have any say. They didn't have any agency or say or power in the room. So basically, other people are speaking for them and taking decisions in their names, and then they are the ones who are getting backlash from it. And to be honest, like, one of the simple ways in which you can tell, or you can where you should suspect that the subject of an advert where DEI is concerned were not in the room, were not part of the people who made the decision, is the way that they go about it is very like anthropological. Like, if you look at the Bud Light commercial, it isn't just that it's a trans woman drinking a Bud Light being silly and funny. Like, the point of the commercial is that she's trans. Like, they have made that the central component of the commercial without saying it explicitly. And I say that because, like, of all the trans people out there who are visible, who are actors, like known actors who've got fame, who are maybe activists, who are maybe conservative, like conservative activists, who are further along in their transition, of all the people they could have chosen, they chose Dylan. And I think they chose Dylan because Dylan is quite visibly at that time a trans woman. And the way in which they went about the commercial, honestly, for me, the exclamation point, i.e. the point of the commercial, was to highlight the fact that they are giving that commercial to a trans person. Now, the reason why I say that trans people most likely, I would almost stake my life on this, were not in the room when the decision to choose or cast Dylan, the reason I can say that they were not there is because they've made like Dylan's transness the subject of the commercial. And the thing about when you are you, you don't view yourself as anything but you, or as anything as yourself. So for example, as a Black person, I don't walk around thinking of myself as a Black person. Or as a woman, I don't walk around thinking of myself as a woman. Or as a gay person, I don't walk around thinking of myself as a gay person. I just am a person. It's only other people who otherize me. So in other people's eyes, I become all those adjectives. I become a Black person. I become a woman. I become a person of a certain age. Through their imagination and their lens, I become those things. And so you can tell that a person, You can tell that a trans person didn't write that, because a trans person would just view themselves as themselves. They wouldn't necessarily make their transness the focus of that commercial, because it's a commercial about Bud Light. It's a commercial about beer. Not to mention, kind of the point for many trans people is to not be identified as a trans person. They ideally want to pass. That's sort of like the highest sort of compliment to their transition, the fact that they can walk down the street or enter a room or participate in a conversation or be in an advert and they aren't identified as a trans person. So why would they want to be in a commercial in which the main focus or the main attention is on the fact that they are a trans person? Clearly that decision, that casting, that commercial was not chosen and not written by a trans person. Same with the Target's Pride campaign, where they had the clothes and the swimsuit, because only, like, okay, what gay people want is to not be stigmatized, to not have derogatory terms thrown at them, to not be held back from opportunities, to not feel like they are being looked at through a magnifying glass by just existing, to be able to walk down the street and be with their partners and have their families and not be gawked at and not be discriminated against in all these subtle and explicit ways, right? That's ultimately what gay people want. And they want that enshrined in law. They want that to just be part of the social fabric. Instead of working towards that, Target's idea, like, what Target hears is that gay people for pride would want some pithy slogans in, like, really colorful clothes. I sometimes wonder as well, who are these clothes for? Who wants to be on a daily basis, on a regular basis, want to be walking down the street wearing, like, a rainbow? I honestly don't think the average adult wants that. What they want is probably, like, more mature, like, sophisticated, like, maybe slogans, more subtle, more discreet, if you have to have slogans. But moreover, they would probably be more impressed or concerned with Target in their company culture, in their employment practices, hiring more gay people, more diverse types of gay people. I don't mean just, like, camp gay white men. I'm talking about different types of gay people. Or, for example, like, giving to charities that are trying to end the death penalty in countries where it is illegal to be same-sex attracted or to be in a same-sex relationship. Or, I don't know, legalizing same-sex unions everywhere. Like, there's just actual real things that Target could be working towards. And instead, you can tell that gay people aren't actually in the room making these decisions, because the things they throw at gay people is, like, stupid stuff like colorful clothes and like silly slogans on their t-shirts, and thinking that the way to, like, celebrate pride is to have, like, swimsuits where trans people can tuck. I mean, they should have, like, diverse swimsuits, sure, but to make that, like, the linchpin of your pride campaign really speaks to the deficit in your imagination and your deficit in actually being invested in supporting gay people in a meaningful way. And also, like I said, like, really showcases the fact that there aren't gay people in these spaces making these decisions. And if there are gay people, they certainly aren't diverse gay people. It's probably, like, the trope that I spoke about. And the reason why, like, having the right people in the room when making these decisions is so important is, one, obviously, you're less likely to get some of this backlash that comes from, like, just being tone deaf and making the wrong choices, but also because you really can't replicate people's perceptions or people, like, the value of people's diversity is that because of their positioning in life, they've had a lifetime of observing things and noticing things and learning things that you could never have access to if you aren't that person if you haven't had that experience, you know? So, for example, like, when people talk about how women are so empathetic, It's not because women are inherently empathetic. It's because they have spent a lifetime being socialized into displaying and practicing behaviors that fall under the empathetic umbrella. Same with like all kinds of like different viewpoints and different ways of being. A thing that makes me think about how deeply ingrained these things are and how you sometimes can't even teach them is my partner for my, I think it was on my 27th birthday, maybe 28th birthday. She took me to this exhibition in London called Soul of a Nation, Art in the Age of Black Power. And it was basically this exhibition that was focusing on art, like art that focused the African-American experience in the period around the civil rights era, in the period immediately before and the period after. And basically you just had like these huge like artists who had done paintings and different types of art forms, different types of mediums, but I was mostly interested in the paintings. Anyway, so we go through this entire exhibition and it's over like a full floor, but it has like 10, 12 rooms, has multiple rooms. And we're going through them and we're watching it. And to be honest, I'm the kind of person in a gallery or museum, I don't like to be there for hours. I like to be there like an hour and a half and then come back and do it, like do the rest of the day. So we were about like an hour and 20 minutes in, like towards the end of like the amount of time I like to be there. And I looked, I had seen probably like hundreds of paintings at this stage. And I look at this one particular one as I was leaving, and something about it stood out to me in contrast to all the other things that I had seen. And I look at it and it was a beautiful painting of like this black woman. She was smiling. She was standing in front of like a window and there was, you know, she just looked like a happy, it was a painting of a happy black woman. And I looked at my girlfriend and I said, that was not painted by a black person. And wouldn't you believe it? We look up the artist and it wasn't a black person. And by the way, in that room, like literally every other artist was either a black person or a biracial person who had painted them. So this one painting happened to have been painted by a white person. And that's the one I looked at and I could tell that it wasn't painted by a black person. Now, this wasn't because it was derogatory or demeaning or the woman wasn't painted in a beautiful way or that there was like any sort of racist symbolism or undertones. Like, you know, sometimes when you see a painting and they've painted the black person with like no tonality in their skin tone, like it's just one color, one flat color, or like the lips have no complexity to them, they're just big, or the eyes are not vibrant, there's no humanity in the eyes. It wasn't any of those things. I could just tell that it wasn't painted by a black person, not because it wasn't a good painting, not because she didn't look happy, not because it was demeaning. It was just, I could just tell. And my girlfriend was so shocked, like she was so spooked by the experience. Other things are like, I can always tell in TV shows whether a person of color, specifically a black person who I tend to focus on, was styled, if their clothes and makeup were chosen by a black stylist. And again, these are the type of things that you just know intuitively from a lifetime of experience, of micro things, of little itty bitty things that taken together can tell you in like a split second or just by looking whether a painting was painted by a black person or a white person. Going back to the diversity issue, the value of having diverse people in the room is that you can never replicate their viewpoints. That's kind of the point. They have unique lived experiences and they've got unique viewpoints and skills and knowledge and just things that they have picked up over the course of their journey that you can't replicate because you aren't that person. You know, it's like sometimes like you will find that people who have grown up in like poverty, and I'm talking about like African poverty, not necessarily European poverty, they will be so clever about making something out of nothing. And sure, there are like, I'm sure MBAs about innovation, about creativity, and about like creating things. You can take that course, but I guarantee you will never have that intuitive sense of being able to just make do with things, of just being able to be resourceful, of just being able to be a lateral thinker, because it comes through a lifetime of practice and also a lifetime of having had to do things out of necessity and having had to do that for a consistent period of time. So when you have diverse people in the room, not only are they bringing like diverse opinions and diverse thoughts and diverse experiences, but they have skills that you can't replicate. Imagine, like, women, for example, are very good at reading the room and anticipating what's going to happen. Now, sometimes when women have been through trauma, they kind of suppress that knowledge. So they will see the red flags, but they will choose psychologically to kind of not see them. And that's why after the fact, they will always say, I knew that felt off, or I knew that was wrong, but they still went with it, because basically trauma kind of has a way of making you ignore your own sense of self-preservation. So anyway, they will have built up that skill set because they've had a lifetime worth of having to worry about being sexually violated by men, by being physically attacked by men. And this is not just like strange men. This is like most women know that even men who are their friends or their cousins or close to them can also be predatory. So you're always on hyper alert. Obviously, there's different levels of hyper awareness. Like the way that you are with a cousin is not going to be the same way you are with like a friend you met at university. There's different levels. But at the back of your mind, there's like an awareness, that a hyper vigilance, a watching the room, listening to the room, watching out for clues, that has been developed because of your own sense of wanting to preserve your own well-being, essentially. If you add people's disadvantages to that, it becomes layered. So a person with disabilities, for example, will be hyper aware of all kinds of things that I will never know. A person who comes from poverty, for example, or poor background, will have all this knowledge around class issues, around the way that the poor are perceived, around the stigma around poverty, that somebody who hasn't experienced poverty, who hasn't lived in poverty, who hasn't been tainted by poverty, will never know. Now, there is a flip side to that. And the flip side of that is that the reverse is also true for people who are on the other side of that dynamic. So a person, for example, let's take a man. Take a white man in white America who lives under white patriarchy. He only has his viewpoint because everything that he sees and experiences and how he takes in the world and how the world responds to him, it responds to him as a white man under white patriarchy. And so there are a whole host of things that he will never see or know or understand. And even if he works towards that understanding, he will get like closer, but he can never get all the way there because you only know what you are. And the reason why you only know what you are is because from the minute that you're born to the minute that you die, you always have your perspective as the main version of what truth is, right? So let's say, for example, you're a man who lives in a world in which people never make or rarely make negative assumptions about you. Like, they don't talk about your group of people, i.e. white men, as being incompetent or as being undeserving or as being unwelcome or as being designed to be subservient or designed to serve. And because all those negative stereotypes and adjectives and expectations are never placed in your path, you can walk through life believing the opposite, that you're supposed to be in these spaces, you can be anything that you set your mind to, you're allowed to be anything, you're welcome in all spaces, you have a stake and a claim in greatness, that greatness that historically has happened. So when you look at the story of Napoleon, for example, you can see yourself represented and feel that like you too potentially could be Napoleon. Or when you look at the accomplishments of any of these other great white men, you feel like you've got a stake in their greatness and you feel like you could be that person, essentially. If you did the right things, if you studied hard and you dedicated yourself, you could feasibly be that person. So that's what comes with your viewpoint, with your perspective. And the thing is that it is only a perspective. It's not an absolute truth, and it certainly isn't an objective truth, because for a great many of society, and I'm not just talking about in the US context, like globally, that's not the reality for people. That's your reality. But because we tend to sort of universalize our own individual experiences, we can astral project our own experiences onto other people. So despite the fact that we've had different experiences, we've got different advantages, we've got different disadvantages, we live through different contexts, we have different upbringings, we have different opportunities, we have different cognitive abilities, we've got different emotional leanings, we have literally so many differences, yet we assume the same, or we have the same expectations for people. That can only happen because we are universalizing our own experiences and our own viewpoints and our own journeys, essentially. And that's what happens when people who are born into relatively more advantageous positions are looking at things. They are always limited by their advantages, because if they believe, for example, that it is not derogatory for them to be looked at sexually, that speaks to their own positions of power. So men don't feel objectified. So when they are sexualized, they see it as a compliment. Whereas women's intellect is routinely dismissed and minimized. And there's an inordinate amount of emphasis placed on their sexuality and their sexual beingness. And that often has negative ramifications for them because they don't choose it. And often the people who sexualize them don't take no for an answer. And so that's why for women, when they are sexually objectified, it's a very negative experience a lot of the time, especially when it's through a work context or it's by somebody who they find intimidating or unattractive or undesirable for whatever reason. It doesn't feel good. Or for example, like, let's say a black family, like a black couple has a black child who's like 7 years old, and the child is trying to be an actor. So he's going for like all these commercials. He ends up booking a commercial with a company like H&M. And H&M in that commercial decide to dress a little boy as a tiger. So there's like all kinds of, there's different boys and different kids on the set for the commercial. And there's Asian kids, there's white kids, and all of them are dressed as something. Some of them are dressed as like houses, some of them are dressed as plants, some of them are dressed as famous people, some of them are dressed as cars. And the little black boy is dressed as a lion. And in the commercial, he has to make like a lion sound and pretend he's like on a safari. And so what happens, and this actually did happen, there's massive outcry from black people in particular, because they say, why on a cast of like 30 kids have you decided to make the one black child the tiger? Now, from the perspective of the people in the room, I can only assume it wasn't done with malice. I can only assume it was done with just ignorance or just a lack of awareness. For them, they saw nothing wrong, presumably, with putting the only black child in the lion costume, because they didn't see anything wrong. But from the perspective of black people and that black family, who historically were treated as animals, who were likened to animals, who were who even now, like athletes, for example, are like footballers and other athletes are routinely like called monkeys and made monkey noises when they are like playing sports. Or there are still textbooks around, like eugenics textbooks, where you can read stuff about like all these like racist scientists who used to liken black people to animals. It's a sensitive spot clearly for black people. And so when they see a cast of like 30 other kids and they're all dressed as other things and they've decided to make the black child the animal of the group, of course they're going to likely be offended because of the historical context. And the other people in the room probably aren't doing it maliciously. I genuinely don't think they're doing it maliciously. It's just that from their perspective, because they haven't had this experience, they don't understand the implications and they don't understand why it's potentially a sensitive thing to do. A final example, when you consider some of the backlash that like emerged when Caitlyn Jenner won Woman of the Year the first year she transitioned, there was a lot of outrage, and the outrage wasn't because a trans person won like Woman of the Year per se. I genuinely don't think that's what it was. It was more that women routinely are not rewarded for the work that they do. Like, they often have to work twice or three times as hard as their male equivalent. They often aren't given positions of leadership, even though they are doing all the leadership work. They often aren't compensated and recognized through awards for their work. And so the reason why there was backlash was that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of women in America alone who every year do fantastic work. Like, they raise money for charity, they make scientific discoveries, they do things that are heroic, they overcome difficult circumstances, they write amazing shows and amazing stories, like lots and lots of accomplished women. And the first year that Caitlyn Jenner is a woman, that comes out as a woman, she wins Women of the Year, which is a spit in the face to the women who have been around for a very long time and who do that work on a daily basis. Because what they're saying, essentially, somebody who's new to being a woman by like not even 12 months at this stage is more deserving of that award. Like, a male-bodied person who transitions into being a woman and who's only been a woman for a year, who BTW has emerged to be like the most MAGA, like conservative, like anti-woman, anti-gay, and even in some cases anti-trans person, they decided to give them the award over all the other women who had been doing all those great things. That's probably the central issue that people had, specifically women had, because they want to be happy for Caitlyn, but they also recognize what the implications are. The implications are somebody, a male-bodied person who has done nothing for women, who's been a woman for 12 months, is more deserving of Woman of the Year prize than all these women who've been doing all this great work. Sticking with the trans theme, I will take a different position on the Dylan Mulvaney and the Target issue. And although I said Dylan Mulvaney is really annoying, she really, really is. And she also portrays women in a very negative light, in my view. That's just my personal taste. I will say that it's not as though Bud Light hasn't had very silly commercials before. Like, I used to love Chuck Norris. And I'm pretty sure Chuck Norris and, like, Dolly Parton and, like, people who are kind of, like, silly or lighthearted have done their commercials before. So the outrage was disproportionate in the sense that although Dylan is annoying, I would say the majority of Bud Light consumers probably didn't know Dylan Mulvaney's like social media content. Like, she hadn't had released her music video yet, which is atrocious. And she honestly, I just don't think she would have been visible to them. So I think they definitely were responding to her transness, the fact that she was a trans person. Not just in the way that she was acting, because she does act in a really annoying sense. I really can't emphasize this enough. But clearly a huge part of the backlash was in reaction or response to her transness, to her being trans. Same with the Target thing. Now with the Target thing, okay, I find the whole rainbow pride like stuff like really lazy and kind of crass, but ultimately it's not that big of a deal. Like, I looked up the pictures earlier, and although it's not to my taste, it's honestly not that big of a deal. Its clothes are there for like a month, and even if you don't like them, Target has all kinds of ugly clothes. So why should it matter that this particular clothes doesn't speak to you? And in terms of like public decency, this is a place that sells guns, as far as I'm aware. So I don't feel like the line, like the hill that they should die on, is that they know that somewhere in their store, there's a bikini that has like a tucking component, that's what's going to like drive them nuts. clearly, like, the trans part, the pride part, the LGBT part is what they are responding to as well. What I will say is this. Clearly, there are conservative values and conservative people all over the place. That's to be expected and that's normal. What the retreat, though, what from DEI policies demonstrates from Target and from companies that have been so quick to dismantle their DEI policies is that they never really supported it. They never really believed in it. They never really wanted to have it there. They, in fact, only really implemented these policies after they had received backlash for their discriminatory practices. If you recall, Target only, like, started focusing on LGBT inclusion when they tried to hire an extremely homophobic CEO and the public found out and there was like massive outcry. So they tried to like erase that memory by doing more like LGBT inclusive stuff. So it didn't come about like organically. It wasn't because they surveyed like the social like dynamics of what's going on in society around LGBT people and gay rights and gay rights activism and decided that they wanted to be part of the movement. No, it was basically like PR. It was basically like damage control. And so if they've been doing damage control and implementing like DEI policies that really they don't support, really don't want to have, are only doing it at the end of the barrel of a gun and doing it because they feel peer pressured, then of course when like President Trump, the orange man, like, signs an executive order saying basically the DEI is over, of course they're going to jump on the bandwagon because they were never truly interested in those policies anyway. And for me, that's, like, the biggest takeaway around this DEI stuff. It's a reminder that corporations, like, are corporations, essentially. Like, one of the things that's really annoying about Pride marches is seeing all those massive corporations with their banners and their statements talking about how they're committed to the LGBT, how they're invested in LGBT rights. But you remember that corporations always jump on the bandwagon after people have gotten their rights. So it's only after, for example, that apartheid ends that many of these corporations start talking about how they were anti-apartheid. But for a very long time, they did not want to lose, like, apartheid South African money. They wanted to be there as long as possible. And then when it was no longer publicly feasible and when it was clear that apartheid was going to fall and that people who were on the wrong side of history were going to be penalized, then they jumped on board. Same with, like, civil rights. Same with, like, literally, even right now, what's happening with the genocide in Palestine, look at all these corporations who we are having to actively boycott to force them to do the right thing. Look at McDonald's, even to this day, still continuing to feed Israeli soldiers. Look at Starbucks, who's refused to leave. Look at companies like Pret A Manger. They're a huge chain here in the UK, a coffee chain. Like, they, despite what was going on around October and over the past year, they were still trying to expand into the state of Israel, even though everybody was saying, we're literally going to boycott your products if you do. And they basically, like, waited until the last possible moment when they realized that consumer activists were serious. Then they pulled out, but they pulled out using a different reason. They basically said something like they were unable to, like, do due diligence, and that's why they were pulling out. But that's not why. They're pulling out because of consumer activism that meant that it was going to tarnish their brand significantly. So again, like, corporations as a general rule jump on the bandwagon after the public has already won the social fight, after it has become clear that being on the wrong side of history, like, after the history has been made, is going to cost them money. And that's why when we look at corporations in general, as a general principle, in particular some of the ones that I've listed before, they are willing to kill us. And by that I mean, they can know that their products are poisonous. They can know that their products, like, ruin the environment or harm the environment. They can know that it has, like, forever chemicals that are going to, like, cause us cancer. And they still give us those products, because ultimately what matters to them is the bottom line and everything else comes secondary. That's why they are seeing where the wind blows with DEI to see what the right marketing strategy is for them. Because that's what it is for them. It's a marketing strategy. When they are using people like Dylan Mulvaney or Caitlyn Jenner, they're not doing it because they care about trans issues. They're doing it because they see it as like their next marketing strategy. They think like the demographics are aligned with the strategy and they are giving it a go. And that's why they don't even like think too deeply about it, because for them, it's a tokenistic practice. I think what I'm going to do, I had like a lot more content to cover under this episode, but it's already nearly at the 1 hour mark. So I think what I'm going to do for next week is I'm going to cover the rest of my content. I wanted to focus on some of these corporations that have ended DEI policies, and I wanted to look at their history, because when you look at their history, it really becomes evident that they were never committed to DEI anyway, because they have pretty like terrible pasts. In particular, I want to talk about companies like McDonald's and Coca-Cola and Citigroup, because they've got really, really interesting histories. So I'm going to park it there for today. I'm sorry this episode is coming out very late on Monday evening. It's like right now 11:05. I'm going to try and post it before the clock strikes 12. Hopefully I'll release it at the regular time on Monday. But in any case, I hope you enjoyed the episode. I hope you are able to listen to the very end. If you have any questions or comments or things you'd like to share with me, I always leave my email in the show notes. So until next week, enjoy your week, and I'll speak to you then.